So let's continue on where we left off in the text. So we've just started the second of the 7 points in the 7-point mind training. And the second one, of course, is training in the two minds of awakening, the main practice. So the two minds of awakening, of course, are conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. Conventional bodhicitta is as what we normally know as bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then ultimate bodhicitta is the realization of emptiness, the wisdom practice, supported on the conventional mind of bodhicitta. And we're looking first here at the ultimate bodhicitta, so we're looking at the wisdom practice here, the vipassana practice, this wisdom of emptiness. And with each of these, we're looking at two parts to the practice, the meditation session and then post-meditation, what we do outside of meditation. And here we're looking at the actual meditation session. And so far we've just looked at how to prepare ourselves, not only at the beginning of this meditation on emptiness, but in general, how to prepare ourselves at the beginning of every meditation session. And so we looked through those steps in the prayers for meditation. And so if we go back to the bottom of page 3 on the left, it says, then generate as a precursor the conventional awakening mind accompanied by the beneficial qualities of meditative stabilization. Meaning that we are to also, as part of the preparation, to have a very calm, clear, focused mind, this mind of shamatha as the basis for vipassana. And if we continue on, it says, during the main session, given that all of these mind training practices adhere to the tradition of simultaneous engagement, you should simultaneously meditate on the emptiness of all phenomena, including that of your own self and the self of others. Although this is true, during the preparatory stage, you must relate to these phenomena in a gradual manner, enumerating each phenomenon by means of the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness. This, the master said, has the benefit of allowing the moisture of tranquil abiding to give birth to the shoots of realization. So a couple of things to say here. First is, it talks about this tradition of simultaneous engagement. And I think this is a little bit coming sort of from more the Nyingma and particularly also Kagyu tradition, where in the Vipassana practice, when they talk about Vipassana, they're really talking about realizing nature of the mind, and they're really talking about simply resting in the nature of the mind and thereby realizing the empty nature of all phenomena simultaneously. So that's what's meant by simultaneous engagement, I think, here. But it said here, even though in the preparatory stage, you must relate to these phenomena in a gradual manner, meaning that in the beginning phase of our Vipassana practice, we need to investigate individually some various phenomena, like the person, the body, the mind, and then also we can look at external phenomena to do that. And that can create the basis of coming to this simultaneous engagement. Particularly here, as we're going to see, we're talking about there is resting in this very subtle mind, this very subtle clear light mind. So as a basis for that, the Vipassana practice is to use the coarse mind that we have to investigate the nature of reality, to investigate the person, the body, the mind, and of course the objects that we perceive. And so we'll see that in the coming slogans. And then it says here that we are to enumerate them by means of the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness. So discriminative awareness here means that we need to investigate, to discriminate how these phenomena exist. How does the person exist? How does the mind exist? How does the body exist? And so forth. And we'll look at how we do that in the coming verses. Then the next sentence says, this the master said. So remember this commentary here is by Sechulbu Chögyi Gyaltsen, who's the main disciple of Geshe Chikawa. And it's really his notes from teachings that Geshe Chikawa gave. So then whenever he says, this the master said, the master is his own master. So whenever you see the word master here in the auto, in the commentary, he's talking about his own teacher, Geshe Chikawa. So he's sort of quoting directly from Geshe Chikawa. Says, has the benefit of allowing the moisture of tranquil abiding to give birth to the shoots of realization. So here this word tranquil abiding is a translation of the Sanskrit word shamatha. So through having the moisture of shamatha, we can give birth to the shoots of realization. And with every practice, we can talk about going through three stages or three steps. And here I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short. The first stage is goal in Tibetan. And goal means intellectual. Which means first, if we're going to do any practice, we need to listen about the practice, we need to reflect on the practice, we need to understand what the practice is. So we have a framework for meditation. So this is intellectual. So first we gain an intellectual understanding of the practice that we're about to do. Then, of course, we meditate, and that leads us to nyam, which means taste or experience. And we'll use the example here that we're currently looking at, the practice of vipassana, the emptiness practice. So then, for the emptiness practice, first we gain intellectual understanding of what we mean by emptiness and how to do the practice. So we have some framework for our practice. Then we sit down and we meditate on emptiness, and we may have some taste or experience of that in meditation. And depending on how stable our mind is, this taste or experience in meditation, here we're talking about emptiness, can still affect our mind outside of the meditation a little bit. And while that's still affecting our mind, this experience of emptiness, the fact that there's nothing existing independently, what you'll find is that during that time, the mind will be more calm, less mental afflictions, and you'll feel a little bit more close to other people, more connected. But it'll wear off, and then we'll go back to our normal habit. So what we want to do, of course, is we want to stabilize this experience. And that is talk, realization. We want to come to realize emptiness, because a realization is a stable experience that will continue to affect us after the meditation. But to get to from taste to realization, we need shamatha. We need a very stable, clear mind. Because if we have anything less than shamatha, it'll simply remain as a taste or experience that'll wear off quite quickly. So for realization, we need shamatha. And that's why often in the context where we're talking about meditating on emptiness, often in the text you'll see something like enter into meditative equipoise on emptiness. The word meditative equipoise is meaning this. It means on the basis of shamatha, go into your vipassana practice to come to realize emptiness. And that's what it's saying here, is that this will allow the moisture of tranquil abiding, the moisture of shamatha, to give birth to the shoots of realization. That if we want to have a realization of emptiness, we need shamatha. That's the minimum level of concentration that is necessary to actually have a realization of emptiness. And there's more to be said about realizing emptiness, but we'll talk about that tomorrow morning. Any question about this? So if we want to have a realization not only of emptiness, but if we want to have a realization of bodhicitta, we need shamatha. Because remember, the entry point into the Mahayana path to enlightenment is when we cultivate bodhicitta. But that cultivating bodhicitta is not merely intellectual, of course. We need to meditate on bodhicitta using this seven cause and effect method, or the exchanging self with others, which is the method here. We need to meditate on that to have a taste of bodhicitta. But then, of course, we want to stabilize that experience. We want to have a stable, a realization of bodhicitta. This is the entry point. When we have this on bodhicitta, we enter into the path. So we need this shamatha, even for having a realization of bodhicitta. So therefore, what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about shamatha. Because shamatha is the basis of all other meditation practices, all these analytical meditations, the Vipassana practice, the bodhicitta practice, all of these practices, if we want to, for them to be effective, if we want to have some sort of realizations, we need shamatha. So I'd like to spend one or two sessions now talking about shamatha. Because all Buddhist traditions, of course, shamatha is one of the core practices. Remember, the three core practices in all schools of all traditions of Buddhism is ethics, concentration, wisdom. So they all say that concentration practice is essential. But actually, if we look at what people are practicing in the various traditions, it seems to get left out. You know, a lot in the Theravada traditions, you hear a lot about Vipassana, 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 Vipassana. In the Tibetan tradition, you often hear about bodhicitta, emptiness, deity yoga, and so forth. All very good practices, but if we don't have a basis of shamatha, we can put a lot of effort into all of these practices and not really get very far. So therefore, and particularly in our modern society, generally our attention skills are not very good. And a lot is to do with modern society. We're simply bombarded by stimulus in modern society, and so our attention is very fragmented. Our minds tend to be very chaotic, so our attention skills are very poor. And so if we bring that into meditation practice, we can spend a lot of effort in Vipassana, in bodhicitta, in emptiness, in deity yoga, and not really get much out of it, barely even getting a taste or experience. Because we're trying to meditate, then we get distracted by something, we fall half asleep, we're all over the place, so nothing goes inside. So therefore, it's important to put effort into the shamatha practice. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that now before we continue on in the text. So, of course, here we're talking about, in the three core practices, ethics, concentration, wisdom, concentration. Concentration is a translation of the Sanskrit word samadhi. So that's a very general term. So So we can develop many levels of samadhi, many levels of concentration. The level of concentration that we mainly talk about here in the Mahayana, also in the Lojong, is shamatha. And shamatha, Sanskrit word, we can divide it into two. Shama means like non-discursive, meaning a mind that is very calm. And ta means to remain or abide. So shamatha is often translated as calm, abiding. Meaning our mind is very calm, and it's abiding, it's focusing on a single object. In Theravada traditions, you won't really see the word shamatha very much. Rather, you'll see the word dhyana. And we can talk about four levels of jhana. So these are higher levels of concentration than shamatha. And so often in the Theravada, when they talk about concentration practice, they talk about developing the jhanas, these four levels. And then above the jhana, there are even four higher levels of concentration. Which are often called the four samapatis in Sanskrit. Often this is translated as absorption. And these absorptions are very peaceful, of course, but the mind is so absorbed that we can't really use it in the Vipassana practice. Because in Vipassana we want to investigate. But here we've really gone beyond investigating because our mind is so withdrawn. So for Vipassana practice, any of these levels here are suitable as a basis for Vipassana practice. In the Mahayana, mainly we're talking about this level called shamatha. So that's what I'm looking at now. Any questions? How to train in shamatha? Of course, as we've seen, we need to prepare ourselves well at the beginning of our practice. Preparing the body, good posture, setting good motivation, bringing the mind into the present moment. And then, what qualities are we to cultivate in this practice? What are we doing in the shamatha practice? So here, of course, we're developing our attention skills, our concentration ability. So we're really developing two qualities. We want to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted. So that's called stability. So the fault that we're trying to overcome there is distraction. But not only do we want to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted, we want to be able to focus on that object in a very clear way. So the second quality we're trying to cultivate here is clarity. So the fault that we're trying to overcome, of course, is dullness. So we want to be able to focus in a very stable and clear way. But I like to add a third quality that's normally not mentioned in the meditation texts. But it's something I think in our modern society we really need to pay attention to. And that is relaxation. Because the reality is that in our modern society, we generally lead very hectic, fast-paced lives. We're constantly bombarded by stimulus. Our attention's therefore very fragmented. Our minds tend to be very chaotic because of that. And then generally, whenever we want to focus on any activity or object, what we tend to do is we tense. Because if we don't tense, we just get swept away. So our normal habit in our modern society, whenever we want to concentrate on anything, is we tense. And if we only need to concentrate for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we focus with a lot of tension longer time, we become completely exhausted and often become very agitated. So this is not the approach we want to follow here in meditation. So the fault, of course, we're trying to overcome is tension. And this is probably the main reason why we have so much difficulty as a beginner in meditation. Is we're simply too tight, we're too tense, we're trying too hard. And then, of course, nothing works. We get agitated, we get exhausted. Even people complain about getting headaches from meditating. Way, way too tight and tense. So the very first thing we need to do is we need to learn how to relax. Relax the body, relax the mind. And unfortunately, this is something that we often have forgotten how to do in our modern society. We're so uptight, so tense in the body and the mind. And that's what we bring into meditation. And if we bring that into meditation, we're going to have all sorts of difficulties in meditation. All sorts of difficulty. And so this is something I think that Renato is emphasizing in the early days of this course, is really just relax the body, relax the mind. Just relax, 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 relax. Because the more that we can relax the body, the more that we can relax the mind, the better that we have a basis for, in this case, for developing a stable and a clear mind. So we need to emphasize these qualities in this order. First, we emphasize relaxing. Then with a more relaxed body and mind, we work on stabilizing our attention. And then with a more stable attention, we work on improving the clarity of attention. And to really highlight the need for relaxation, I'd like to read a little bit from a book by Alan Wallace called Attention Revolution. So it's a book he wrote about shamatha practice. It's actually the one I recommend if you want to know more about shamatha practice. And he has a little section here about the importance of relaxation. So I'd like to read that out. And he's using the example of focusing on the breath as the object. He says, "Thus, our practice of mindfulness of breathing consists of prolonging our awareness of our breath. While this requires an alert mind, such concentration should not be tense, but rather balanced. When we discover that we have become distracted from the meditation object, it may feel natural to clamp down more forcefully, tightly concentrating the mind. You can see this in the facial expressions of people who try to concentrate in this way. Their lips become pursed, their eyebrows draw together, and their foreheads become furled with wrinkles. They're becoming concentrated, but like orange juice, Most of the fluidity is being drained from their minds. If you want to concentrate for a short time and don't mind the side effects of tension and fatigue, you can follow the above strategy. But if you want to follow the path of shamatha, you'll need an alternative. I had to discover this fact through experience. During my first extended shamatha retreat, I was filled with enthusiasm. I wanted to take full advantage of the rare opportunity that was before me, for I was meditating in India under the guidance of the Dalai Lama. In fact, he was meditating here just above Dharamkot. Just above Dharamkot, there's a little ridge with some meditators' huts up there. That's where he was meditating. I had no financial worries, and my material needs were easily met. All I had to do was to put the instructions into practice. I threw myself into this training with all my might. Each morning, I would rise at 3:30. Except once, I slept in until 3:45 and got upset with myself for slacking off. Enthusiastic I was, but so uptight. The Tibetan manuals on shamatha meditation that I had studied over the years stated that the type of attention needed when one began such practice was, quote, highly focused. So I tried as hard as I could to keep my mind from wandering. Within a matter of a few weeks, devoting many hours each day to meditation, I could sustain my attention on my chosen object for up to half an hour. I was elated by making such fast progress. As the weeks went by, however, I found myself becoming more and more fatigued. I was draining myself both physically and mentally. My joy in the practice was diminishing accordingly, and I felt my attention was not developing any further. What was wrong? I was trying too hard. The cultivation of shamatha involves balancing the mind, and that includes balancing the effort exerted in the practice with relaxation. I think this points to a cultural difference between traditional Tibetans living in the highlands of Tibet and modern people leading fast-paced lives. Their senses constantly bombarded by telephones, email, the media, and noise. Years of such existence condition the nervous system and mind in ways that might have been considered torture in rural Tibet. One traditional Tibetan doctor whom I know once commented on people living in the West. So now he's quoting the Tibetan doctor who says the following. From the perspective of Tibetan medicine, you are all suffering from nervous disorders. But given how ill you are coping remarkably well. Whether we dwell in Boston, Buenos Aires, Berlin, or Beijing, our minds are conditioned to be more high-strung and engaged in compulsive thinking than the minds of Tibetan nomads and farmers living a century ago. So when Tibetan meditation manuals advise beginners to focus their attention firmly, the instructions are aimed at a very different reader than the average city dweller in the 21st century. Before we can develop attentional stability, we first need to learn to relax. So relax, 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 and then relax more. It's only on the basis of a relaxed body and mind that we're going to be able to sustain any sort of stability and clarity. And also, if we go into a meditation retreat, particularly this shamatha practice, and we're doing many hours a day of shamatha practice with tension, not only are we going to get completely exhausted, we're going to get so agitated. And we'll get a condition in Tibetan Buddhism called lung. Lung is Tibetan for wind. It means subtle energy. And it's a complete imbalance in our subtle energy system. Because if we're so tight and tense, pushing, 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 for a long period of time, we can really get these subtle energies completely out of balance. Of course, now in our modern society, we push, 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 but then we sort of relax, push, 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 relax, push, 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 relax, have some beer, take some drugs, watch some TV, relax, push, push, we sort of do all this. So we never build up beyond a certain level. But if we're in meditation retreat, hour after hour, day after day after day, we keep pushing, 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 because I'm in retreat now, I've got to make use of my time, I really got to strive, I've got to get somewhere, push, 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 then what's going to happen? And I know from personal experience, and a number of friends of mine who did this, and I did it as well, you get this lung, and then you get very agitated, and you can't even meditate anymore. You have to stop. And it's very hard to overcome. It takes a long time to overcome it. So we don't want to go in that direction. And again, I know from personal experience. So therefore, whether we're doing a meditation retreat or we're just doing a little bit of daily shamatha practice, the first thing we need to do is relax, 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 body and mind. And keep relaxing more and more and more. The more you can relax, the more you'll be able to develop sustainable stability and clarity. Question?
Yes, because I see that, and I see the normal activities we have, for example,
the what, sorry?
Normal activities we have in our society, normally when we are in town. And for example, if I do meditating and then I see television for 2 hours, is it fitting?
It's what?
To see the television, for example, the changing channels all over the place, and I don't know, completely the opposite of what we are doing now.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, our modern society, like I said, this constant bombarding of stimulus is a disaster for our attention skills. I mean, now, particularly young children who are growing more up in this, you know, constantly on their mobile phone and texting and so forth, absolute disaster. Absolute disaster for concentration skills. So therefore, we need to work against that. And this is the practice that can help us.
Then we unplug the TV?
I think we don't need to see 2 hours of TV every night. No. Not so helpful. Not so helpful. Okay. So these are the qualities that we are cultivating in this shamatha practice, overcoming these fogs. Then the question can be, what object should we use for this practice?
Screens and all of that.
The what, sorry?
The screens, the children are like really, really exposed to this, the phone, the TV and stuff like this. So it's like an educational question that we are like asking ourselves as educator. What can you do with this? I mean, because they're like attached to it. I mean, if they don't get it, they go mad. And how can you work with it though? I mean, that's like, do you have some insight?
Well, of course, I think we need a sort of a radical change, not only in education system, I mean,
yeah. You
know, we need to sort of change the perspective of society. And fortunately, there's a thing called what's called tipping point. I don't know if you've heard about it. But our society over centuries has gone through 3 or 4 major transitions. And to a more sort of higher and inclusive level. And the one where we are at the moment, this researcher was saying that basically the next tipping point will be more this sort of global awareness, you know, more a little bit sort of like the sort of the bodhicitta, this sort of not this me focus that many people have now, but more a global perspective. And this researcher was, and basically history has shown that for there to be a major transition to the next level in the world, you need 10% of the population at that level. Then there can be a radical transition. And this researcher was estimating that this transition point which we're coming to, this more global awareness, is where there's about 6% of the population is at that level. So he's saying that we need to nudge it up to 10%. and then there'll be a radical transformation in the world. And what he was saying is, if we don't do that soon, we're going to destroy the planet, basically. That was what he was saying. We have to get to that 10% very quickly, otherwise we're going to destroy the planet. And I think part of that will be also this this more shift in terms of this global awareness and not me, 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 I need this, I need this, I need this. So if that can happen, then of course, you know, you can have a flow down effect through education, through parents, through everything down to the children.
Yeah.
If that's not there, I mean, if the parents are still doing this as well, and I mean, what chance have we got?
Yeah, because, you know, because I'm in my daily work in, back in Israel, I work a lot with parents also. And they're always, like, you know, debating among themselves with their children to give them a phone or not to give them a phone. You know, all of that. And it starts to become more and more in more and more younger ages. And then it's like, but everyone has it, and then they want it too. So it's like, I don't know what, some of the time it's like, I don't know what to tell them about it.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, I think in that case, of course, unless the parents have a more broader awareness, and if they're caught up in the same, I need more, 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 then we're fighting a losing battle, because
mm-hmm.
we need to, for it to go down from parents to children, from educators to children, and so we need that sort of more global change. But of course, we as an individual can do what we can to educate as well the parents in terms of the benefits of a different way of thinking and working and so forth, and hopefully they'll get something of that and pass it on to the kids and then in the education system as well. Okay, objects.
Can I ask a random question?
Sure.
Like, when you did your 1 year meditation thing, is it like in noble silence or do you talk in between?
If you're doing a retreat, you mean?
Yeah, like when you said you were doing 1 year of like meditation.
Yeah. So, when we do meditation retreat, of course, generally what I recommend in the beginning is to do group retreat. It's much easier. Because as a beginner, to even do 1 week solitary retreat, very difficult. Because we have got no, what's the word I'm looking for? We have no perseverance. You know, we have, because we have to motivate ourselves, we have to be disciplined, and very difficult to do. So if we start with group retreats, then there's a structure. There's someone guiding, all you have to do is turn up, and then there's the group energy that supports as well. So if we start with some group retreats and get in the habit of meditating a number of hours every day, then we can slowly start to do some personal retreat. But again, maybe 1 day, a weekend, 3 days, so forth. And then we can build up to a week, a month, and longer. And so in those retreats, of course, if we do our longer retreat, a month or more, then of course, in general, of course, the solitary retreat is to not communicate with others unnecessarily. Sometimes, of course, in a longer retreat, you may need to communicate with your teacher because you have got some questions about something in your practice, okay? And sometimes if you're in a retreat center and there's some logistical problem, maybe your water's not working in your hut or something, you have to talk to someone to fix it, you know, things like that. But outside of that, then if we can really remain sort of within our own space and really work within ourselves, then that's going to really be very, very helpful. So therefore, in general, with those solitary retreats, to minimize the amount of communication, only to limit it to really necessary communication, either with teacher or logistical matters about getting food and so forth. So otherwise to be silent. And my experience in that retreat was, you know, occasionally I needed to speak to someone at the center for some logistic thing, but, you know, I'd go weeks on end without seeing or talking to anyone. And really it's so beneficial, so beneficial.
What's the longest time you spent in a retreat?
Well, though I did an 8-month retreat, there was the longest one. But again, we shouldn't think longer is better. Because often people feel, oh, okay, the solution to all this is I just got to give up everything and I got to go and meditate for 3 years and then everything will be fixed. It's not going to work. Because often when people do that, within 2 weeks they run back out because they're not ready for that. It's not the right thing to do for them at that time. So with all of these practices, there is inner development and outward expression. You know, meditation and daily life. So there are times where we need to emphasize inner development. So then we maybe go and do a retreat for a week, a month, a year, whatever. But then we need to have outward expression. And we need to do something in society regarding that. So we need to have that balance. But what the balance looks like will vary from one individual to another. And within an individual, it could vary in different periods of our life. In certain periods of our life, it may be better to do a longer retreat. In other periods of our life, it may be better to spend a lot of time in society doing things. So how to strike the balance is where the qualified teacher can be very helpful. They can really see where we're at and what would be best for us right now. They may say, for you, I think it's good for you to do a 1 month retreat on this now. Maybe for you, it's good for you to go and benefit society, go and help in society more. So again, it's a balance between the two. It's not a, we shouldn't think that we'll fix all of these problems if we just run off and meditate in a cave for a long time. I think it's not going to work. Okay, objects. What object should we use in the shamatha practice? What should we focus on? The general recommendation is use the object that works best for you. And then the text gives a list this long of possibilities. Within that list of possibilities, often the text will say something like, if you're the sort of person who's highly discursive, meaning always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. And I think this accounts for about 95% of the modern day population. We're all living in the head. So much, many of us have obsessive compulsive thinking, always thinking, 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 thinking. Often tormented by our thinking. By focusing on the breath, of course, we get out of the conceptual mind into the body. So that's a good start. And most of our conceptual thinking is about the past and the future. Very rarely are we in the present moment. And from a Buddhist perspective, living in the past and the future is a source of a lot of unhappiness. And modern studies are coming to the very same conclusion now. The physical sensations of the breath only happen in the present moment. So by focusing on them, we get out of our conceptual mind into the body. We get out of the past and the future into the present moment. So probably for many of us here, the best object in shamatha practice will be the breath. And that's the one that's most widely emphasized in most Buddhist traditions. And in the breath practice, we can talk about three variations. There's what's called the full body shamatha practice. And this is simply noticing sensations anywhere in the body associated with the breathing. And because this is a very diffuse object, this practice is very helpful for relaxation. Particularly this practice together with the Shavasana, corpse posture, lying flat on your back and noticing sensations anywhere in the body as associated with the breathing, emphasizing relaxation. Very good for relaxation. So if we're the sort of person who's very agitated, very uptight and tense, then maybe that's the best meditation for us now, is use the Shavasana posture, full body, relax, relax, relax. And then another variation of the breath practice is widely recommended, often particularly in Theravada traditions, is to focus on the abdomen, the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. Smaller area of focus, but easy to focus on. So this is particularly good for helping to stabilize our attention. And in another variation of the breath practice, focusing at the nostrils. Very small area here at the entrance of the nostrils. Because it's a much smaller area of focus, more subtle object, it can be very helpful for improving the clarity of our attention. So each one of those is particularly helpful for cultivating those qualities. Does that mean we have to start here, then go to here, then go to here in our practice? No. It just means each one of them is particularly good for that quality. And you'll be cycling through these objects with Renato. You're probably already starting on the abdomen. You'll be starting nostrils tomorrow. Is it? Nostrils tomorrow. Because this is probably the most commonly used object, and probably for many of us it's going to be the best object. But also in this course we're introducing two other objects in our shamatha practice in the morning with Renato. Two other objects that also are particularly useful for us in our modern society. The first one of those two is the mind. And so in this practice, we are simply observing the mind as the object. So we're observing the mind, and then whatever's coming up in the mind, thoughts, emotions, memories, so forth. Many people find this much more challenging than the breath, because the mind is more subtle. It's not physical, whereas the breath is physical, more easy to focus on. And also in this practice, we are simply observing the mind and we're being like an impartial observer or witness, observing whatever's coming up in our mind, just observing thoughts, emotions, memories, images, arising, passing, arising, passing, arising, passing. And that's something many of us are not used to doing. Because usually what happens for us is if something comes up in our mind, a thought, emotion, memory, image, we do one of two things automatically. Most commonly, we grab hold of it, we follow it, we get caught up in it. Or if it's unpleasant and we don't know how to deal with it, the other thing we often do is stuff it back down, suppress it. Both of those options are a disaster for us. With both of those options, we end up becoming the slaves of our mind. We become tormented by our own mind. Because every time you get caught up in a thought, emotion, or memory, we get caught up in our stories, we often get overwhelmed by them. And every time we get caught up in them, we're feeding them, which means the habit of this garbage to come up in our mind will get stronger and stronger and stronger. Obsessive compulsive thinking, more and more and more and more. And then, of course, we don't like that, so we fight with our mind. We try and get rid of that. We try and suppress all of that stuff because we don't know how to deal with it. Also a disaster, because trying to suppress it is not dealing with it. It's just building up a pressure cooker, and then often we eventually explode. And then also by suppressing it, a lot of this negative mental stuff manifests as physical problems in the body. I think a lot of modern day physical illness is suppressed mental content. And then also what we do is then we project a lot of this negativity onto the people around us. So it's an absolute disaster suppressing. Now, some modern therapies really do appreciate that suppressing like anger, suppressing negative memories and thoughts and that is very harmful to us. But unfortunately, as part of the therapy, they say, let it out, express it. Disaster. Of course, let's say, for example, we have an anger issue. Let it out, express it. So sometimes the therapy is shout at a wall, hit a pillow or something. Let it out. Okay, for a short time, the tension is gone. But all we've done is we've increased our habit of getting angry. That's all that's happened. Which means tomorrow, instead of smashing a pillow, we may be smashing someone's face. So we don't need to express to overcome suppression. This practice can help us. Because in this practice, we're simply observing. We don't need to fight with our mind. Fighting with our mind is like throwing petrol on the fire. It's just going to get worse. All we need to do is just step back and watch. Very simple. Step back and watch. Do nothing except watch. Don't try and fix anything. Don't try to change anything. Whatever's there, observe it. And if we can observe these things arise and pass, we can observe thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth arise and pass, we're not feeding them. Which means the habit of them coming up will get weaker and weaker and weaker. Our mind will naturally become more quiet and still over time. Also, if we get in the habit of being able to observe these mental events without getting caught up in them, then if some point later some strong mental event were to arise, we could simply be present with it without it overwhelming us. Because if we look at what a thought, emotion, or memory really is, it's virtually nothing. In itself, it has no power to harm us whatsoever. Thoughts, emotions, and memories only have power if we give them power. And we give them power by identifying with them or trying to suppress them. Then they have a lot of power to harm us. But if we can simply step back and observe, they can't do anything to harm us. So we will really become the masters of our mind. Our mind will naturally become more quiet and still, and we'll become the masters of our mind. And also by not suppressing, we can start the healing process. Because often the healing process for suppressed negative mental events is to acknowledge them. And even simply acknowledge them can really start the healing process. So this practice of observing the mind has enormous benefits in our modern society in particular. And so we're going to start to do that, I think, day after tomorrow, maybe, with Renato. Spend a couple of days on that. And then towards the end of the course, we're going to move on to what's sometimes called shamatha with no object. Or sometimes it's called awareness of awareness. In this practice, we are simply resting in the experience of awareness itself. Many people find this very challenging. Not because it's complicated, because it's too simple. Because we always want to do something. Often when this practice is explained, people go, but what am I got to do? What am I doing in this practice? That's the problem. Doing is the problem. Stop doing, and then you're doing the practice. It's about being. So in this practice, we are simply being aware of being aware. And because it's so simple, people find it very difficult. Because it means not doing, it means being. And I think in our modern society, we've lost the ability to be present, to be just simply present, to be aware of being aware. Because we're always caught up in appearances. We're always engaging in appearances, caught up, either engaging or suppressing, go, 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 non-stop. We've lost the ability to just be. And so this has enormous benefits in our modern society. Is to really be, just rest in that awareness. And if we rest in that experience of awareness itself, what we notice is that awareness is completely still and completely spacious. And if we can get in the habit of resting in that state, not only do we get out of our obsessive compulsive thinking, but then we can bring that state into daily life. Meaning we can still be resting in the stillness of awareness, be grounded in that, and engage in activities without getting caught up in everything. And also by resting in awareness, resting in the experience of awareness, we can intuitively come to have an experience or sense of the nature of our own mind. Simply resting in that experience. So it's a very much, even though this is a shamatha practice, very much it's a bridge into the vipassana practice. Very common that by simply being aware, we can intuitively have an insight into the very nature of our own mind, which of course is vipassana practice. So it's a very much a bridge into vipassana practice. Question?
it's one step back. Maybe it sounds like a naive question, but how do you suppress feelings? I don't want to suppress them, but is, like, if I feel angry and I go running around the block, is this suppressing feelings?
Well, first off, feelings, it's a technical point. The word feeling in Buddhism doesn't mean emotion. Usually when we see the word feeling in Buddhism, it's a translation of the Sanskrit word vedana. And feeling is a mental factor which simply experiences things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So generally when you see the word feeling in Buddhism, it doesn't mean emotion. It just means experiencing things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that was just a little technical point there. But of course, if we have some anger arising, then suppressing it is not one acknowledging it, and then we can just distract ourselves, and really involves often not acknowledging it, just pushing it down.
Okay, I think I got
it. Any questions about these? Any of these three objects? Yeah.
I'm not sure I can really differentiate between two and three.
Okay, good question. Yeah. Okay. This practice, experientially, we have a sense of being the observer or the witness. We're observing our mind and anything that arises in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, images. We're observing them as they come up and pass, arise and pass. So that's the object, the mind plus all of these things. Thoughts, emotions, memories, images. That's the object. In this practice, experientially, there's not really a sense of being a separate observer or witness. Like if we use an analogy for this practice, often the analogy is that the mind is like the sky and the thoughts, emotions and so forth are like the clouds moving through the sky. So we're observing the clouds moving through the sky of the mind, experientially. This practice is not so much observing the sky of the mind, it's being the sky. So in this practice, we are simply being aware of being aware. We're not interested in any appearances here. So in this practice, of course, thoughts, emotions, memories will continue to arise. But in this practice, we're not paying attention to them. We're not blocking them, but we're not interested in them. Here, we're very much interested in them. We're looking at them deliberately. In this practice, we're ignoring them. Couldn't care less what appears. Ignore it. Just rest in the experience of being aware. Know that you're aware. That's it. So it's like being the sky versus observing the sky. Okay. These are the three objects that we're going to use in this course. Of course, there are many other objects that are possible. Often in particularly Tibetan Buddhism, where the highest level of practice is Vajrayana or Tantra, and there we do a lot of visualizing of deities and Buddhas and so forth, then sometimes what's presented as the object for shamatha practice, and those of you who've studied Lam Rim a little bit know this very well, often there in the Lam Rim, when we talk about shamatha, they recommend using as the object a mental image of a Buddha. Use that as the object. Many of us in our modern society find that very difficult. One is we're not really familiar what a Buddha looks like. And secondly, many of us don't have very good visualization skills. So many people who try this find it very difficult. But some people who are more gifted in visualization, maybe like artists or architects or designers, maybe find this mental image of a Buddha a very good object. So if you find that works for you, use it. And then sometimes in this practice it says, oh, you find it even difficult to begin focusing on the breath? Okay. Start with a physical object. Pick a stick or a pebble, put it in front of you and look at it. Start there. And once you get a little bit more relaxed, stable, clear, then shift from looking at the object to a mental image of the object. Because a visual object, won't be able to take us very far in the practice. But it could be a starting point if we're completely agitated and distracted and we can't even really begin with the breath. So sometimes that's mentioned in the text. So as I said, we'll be moving through these objects in the morning sessions with Renato. And I want to talk a little bit more about these two practices in the coming days as well. Give you a little bit more information. So this is just a brief introduction into them. So any questions about any of the objects?
Do we have to stick to one object or can we... because I tried Japanese meditation, Thai meditation, Sri Lankan meditation, and so...
Of course, this is not Zen or Thai or Tibetan. It's just shamatha. Mm-hmm. It's not even Buddhist. I mean, shamatha is not a Buddhist practice. Shamatha is concentration skill. So this can be... We need this... Whether even we're not following a tradition, even if we're a complete atheist, shamatha practice is very good for us because it develops our ability to have a very stable, clear, focused mind. So this practice is not even Buddhist. It's just a practice to develop our attention skills. That's it. And what's very much recommended is in this practice, pick an object that works for you and stick with it. Don't keep changing. Because if you keep changing, you're not really going to go very deep into the practice. So very much recommended is find an object that seems to work for you and just stay with that. And we're going to look at, in the next, tomorrow morning, or in fact, yeah, tomorrow morning, we're going to look at how we progress through the stages of shamatha practice. There's a chart that you have in the back of your booklet that talks about 9 stages we go through. And we can use any one of these objects to go through the 9 stages to the goal of shamatha. But now that you've brought up that question, again, I'd like to read a little bit from Alan Wallace, what his recommendation is. So again, this is in Attention Revolution. I think it was on page 6 from memory. Yeah, page 7. And he talks about what object to use to go through these 9 stages to shamatha. And he says, to guide meditators along these 10 stages, so he's talking about the 9 stages plus the goal of shamatha, I have chosen from Buddhist teachings 3 techniques that I have found effective for people living in the modern world. These 3 techniques are the basis for the 3 divisions of this book. For the first 4 stages, you should practice whatever method you find easiest. By stage 5, the mind is relatively stable and you can move on to subtler techniques. For achieving the first 4 stages, I recommend the practice of mindfulness of breathing, so the first one, variations of which can be found in Zen, Vipassana, and Tibetan Buddhism. Mindfulness of breathing means settling your awareness on the sensations involved in breathing, continually returning your attention there whenever your mind wanders. Beginning with the 5th stage, I recommend a method called settling the mind in its natural state. So that's what he calls the second practice of observing the mind. In this technique, you direct your attention to mental experiences, that is, all the events such as thoughts, mental images and emotions that arise in the domain of the mind. This method is drawn from the Dzogchen, or Great Perfection lineage, but is found in other Buddhist traditions as well. With the instructions for the 8th attentional stage onward, we move on to the still subtler practice of maintaining awareness of awareness itself. The technique is called shamatha without an object. Here the practice is not so much one of developing attentional stability and clarity, as it is of discovering the stillness and clarity inherent in awareness itself. The training in mindfulness of breathing may be helpful to anyone, including those seeking to prevent or treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. Many people find the second practice, that of settling the mind in its natural state, to be more challenging. But some meditators take to it naturally. Likewise, the practice of awareness is subtler still, but it may be optimal from the beginning for those who are strongly drawn to it. You may use any one of the three methods to progress along all stages of attentional development, or you may follow the sequence described in this book. How fast you progress will depend on the level of your commitment and the degree to which your lifestyle and environment support such practice. So what he's saying is that we can use any one of these from the beginning right through to the end, to shamatha. Or another option he recommends is that for the first four stages, and we'll look at what these stages look like tomorrow morning, use the breath because it's the easiest. And then by stage four, our mind is more stable, clear. Then we can shift to this practice and get into the practice more easily. Use that till about stage eight, and then shift into this practice to finish the job. So that's, he says, is another possibility. What's not recommended is keep changing the object 1 week to the next. That's counterproductive. Okay. Right. So let's have a look now at the training. So if again, for this we'll use the handout in the back of your booklet, the shamatha chart. And there's a page opposite. So the diagram we'll look at in more detail tomorrow morning. So I just want to briefly look at now the table in the page opposite. And above it, it says shamatha is attained by progressing through the nine stages, relying on the eight antidotes to abandon the five faults. So the nine stages are in this diagram. We see nine diagrams on this windy road up to shamatha. And we'll look at those in some more detail tomorrow morning. But let's just have a look now here at the faults and the antidotes. So we see here that we progress by abandoning these five faults using these eight antidotes. So the first fault is laziness. And here, the first antidote to laziness is faith. So like everything in our daily life, if we see no benefit in an activity, we're going to be very lazy when it comes to doing that activity. We're not going to put any effort in because we don't see any benefit. Similarly here, if we see no benefit in shamatha practice, we're not going to put any effort into it. We're going to be very lazy. So therefore, the antidote is to reflect on the benefits of the practice. That by doing this practice, what benefits will we receive? So of course, the shamatha practice, the benefit is that we're going to develop a more stable, clear, focused mind, which means we're going to be more effective in everything we do in our life, much less stress, much less agitation, much more peaceful mind, and that's going to probably translate into benefits in the physical body, much better mental balance, much less mental afflictions coming up in our mind. There's a very nice part of the text from the great Indian master Shantideva from the 8th century. He says, those with a distracted mind are caught in the jaws of the mental afflictions. Meaning if our mind is distracted, more easily to develop mental afflictions. If we have a more calm, focused mind, it's much harder for mental afflictions like anger and jealousy and craving to arise in our mind. And of course, by developing the shamatha, not only do we have a lot of these immediate benefits, but then we have an effective basis for our vipassana practice. We can then much more easily come to an insight into the nature of reality. So if we reflect on all these benefits of shamatha practice, then we're going to have the first antidote, faith. So faith here is we're going to have faith in the practice, that the practice is going to bring us benefit. And then, of course, if we have faith that the practice is going to benefit us, that'll lead to aspiration. We'll want to do the practice, so that's aspiration. And then when we have aspiration to do the practice, that's going to lead to the third antidote. We're going to start to put more effort into the practice. And then the more effort that we put into the practice, the more we'll start to have the fourth antidote, is pliancy. And here pliancy means flexibility or serviceability of body and mind. And I'll talk more about this tomorrow morning, but now our body and mind are not very flexible or serviceable. We have a lot of aches and pains in our body when we meditate, and also our mind has a lot of resistance to meditating. The more we practice shamatha, the less problems we're going to have with the body, the more less resistance from our mind. And this is what pliancy means. And we're going to talk about that more tomorrow. The second fault is forgetfulness. And forgetfulness here can mean forgetting the instructions or forgetting the object. So the antidote to that is mindfulness. And here mindfulness is a translation of the Sanskrit word smriti, the Pali word sati. And both of these words literally mean to remember. So mindfulness is our ability to remember the object. So mindfulness is our ability to not forget the object. It's our ability to be able to hold the object without forgetting it, without becoming distracted. What we need to appreciate is that mindfulness now has become very popular in our modern world. But often a lot of the modern day mindfulness movements have redefined the word mindfulness. So now often the way the word mindfulness is used is a little bit different than the original idea of mindfulness in Buddhism. A lot of modern traditions define mindfulness as something like a non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Very good thing to do, but it's not how mindfulness was originally defined. So we need to be a little bit aware of that, otherwise it could be some confusion. So the word mindfulness is smriti sati, literally means memory, to remember. So simply it's our ability to remember the object, to hold the object without becoming distracted. And then we have the next fault, the pair of laxity and excitement. So laxity is the technical word for dullness, and this is stopping, of course, clarity. And excitement is the most common form of distraction. We often get distracted by the so-called sense pleasures. And so hence, instead of distraction, we see the word excitement here, because this is the most common form of distraction. So what's the antidote to dullness and distraction, or laxity and excitement, is introspection. So introspection here is quality control. So these two tools of mindfulness and introspection we see symbolized, if we look over the page in the diagram, we see the meditator down the bottom. And in the left hand, the meditator has a rope. And that rope is symbolizing mindfulness, because we are tying our mind with the rope of mindfulness to the object. But then we need quality control. We need to monitor that. How is our mindfulness going? Are we still holding the object, or are we becoming dull or distracted? So that's introspection. Introspection is quality control, is monitoring that. And if we notice that we become dull or distracted, we come back to the object, reapply mindfulness. And so that symbolized introspection in the right hand is a hook, the hook of introspection, to hook our mind back when we become dull or distracted. The fourth fault is non-application. Non-application means we've noticed that our mind has become dull or distracted, but we don't do anything about it. That's a problem. That's non-application. So the antidote to that is application. And here application means fix it. So generally, if we've become dull or distracted, application means reapply mindfulness. hold the object again, go back to the object again. And then the fifth fault, over-application, is not something that is a big problem for us as a beginner, but as we advance in the shamatha practice, it can start to become a problem. And over-application means that we're actually focusing on the object quite well, but we keep adjusting our focus unnecessarily. So that's a problem. So the antidote here is equanimity. And here, equanimity, the word equanimity here means balance. It means our mind is already balanced. Leave it as it is. Don't touch it. So here, of course, the saying is, if it's not broken, don't fix it. So that's over-application. So again, as a beginner, usually our mind is broken, so we have to keep fixing. We always get dull and distracted, so we have to keep fixing, keep fixing, keep fixing. But at some point, when we get better at focusing, and we're focusing quite well, and we keep fixing unnecessarily, that's a problem. And that's the last one. So they are the five faults and the eight antidotes. So if we apply those eight antidotes, we'll slowly move along these nine stages to shamatha. And we'll look at how we progress along those nine stages in the first session tomorrow morning. But is there any last question before we finish today about this? Or everyone's already achieved shamatha, so I'm just wasting my time in this explanation. I got you, didn't I? See? Be good.
I just had a question about adjusting the back when you're sitting. Do you always have to be aware of it? Because it's in between tense, being tense and relaxing. So.
Well, it shouldn't be tense. Usually it's tense, it means... The most common reason it's tense is we're not sitting enough cushions, and so we're very stiff in here, which means that to keep the back straight, we have to tense to keep it straight because we're not flexible in here. So if you're finding that you're tensing to keep it straight, and then all of a sudden over time it sort of goes like this, generally it's because we're not sitting on enough cushions. And usually also the knees are sticking up a little bit. So then jack up the cushions, keep more until... Your back is naturally straight and you don't have any tension in the lower back. And if you can also try the stools, can also be helpful because they're quite high, but also just more cushions, just so that back is naturally straight. We shouldn't be straining the back to keep it straight.
So at that point, the back will just stand on its own?
Should do, yes.
Okay.
Unless, of course, some people have spinal problems, and then, of course, we need to work with that. But assuming we don't have any spinal problems, then... Usually it's just because we're stiff in the hips, and so we just need to sit on more, and then you'll find your back will be more naturally straight.
The thing is that today a lot of the people have the lower back pains.
Yeah, and one of the reasons is we have bad posture due to our sitting over computers like this all day, and so therefore what can be helpful also is to do some body work to improve.
Okay.
Body work, I mean yoga, but also even some sort of gym work, strengthening the lower back muscles. Because often, because of our bad posture, lower back muscles are very weak, so we need to strengthen them a little bit. So if we can do some sort of physical exercise and target that area, and this is a thing that I also had. I used to have very poor lower back muscle strength, and so over the years I've done some back work and yoga and other things, and now it's a lot better.
So for people that come for first time, what would you recommend them to do?
Come first time.
In meditation and stuff like this, if they have lower back pain, so more cushions and then...
Well, again, often the most common thing that helps immediately is sit on more cushions because they're straining. But of course, if their lower back muscles are weak, then it would be good for them to do some body work to strengthen those muscles. And, of course, work on their posture in general and not sit like this all day, This is not going to be very helpful.
Yeah.
And, of course, at work, they have now these ergonomic chairs and stuff where you actually sit much more upright and so forth. So these can be very helpful. Okay, let's leave it there. Finish for today.